From Kansas to North Carolina, Missouri to Maine, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration has imposed a tidal wave of new federal regulations. Wayne Cruz is co-author of 10,000 Commandments, an annual snapshot of the federal regulatory state. He is here with details. New polling shows the Commonwealth of Virginia has become a battleground state as President Biden's lead over Donald Trump has shrunk dramatically. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The candidate some call the Argentinian Donald Trump has won that country's presidency. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to discuss what that means for the American right. And people are moving to Florida for more than just its sunny climate. Low taxes and a frugal state government are also part of the allure. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Federal regulations declined during the Trump administration, but the number of new rules has exploded since President Joe Biden took office. Wayne Cruz is the Fred L. Smith Fellow in Regulatory Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and is co-author of 10,000 Commandments, an annual snapshot of the federal regulatory state. He is here to discuss the report. Wayne, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Wayne, the study 10,000 Commandments, an annual snapshot of the federal regulatory state. This is a study that you and your counterparts at the Competitive Enterprise Institute have been putting together for a number of years. So let's start out by reminding our listeners what the study is and tell us a little bit about your methodology.
Put it this way, there is the ordinary tax that everybody sees, the federal budget that everybody sees, which is now, unfortunately, $33 trillion in debt, spending around $6 trillion a year. That's the above board tax. There's also what some refer to as the hidden tax of regulation. This is economic regulation, environmental regulation, health and safety, social, and of course, all the paperwork costs that go along with that. So the government gets things done by spending, but also by regulating. It's been 30 years since I did the first edition. And the way I like to think of it is in the same way you can look up the federal government's spending habits and its debt and its outlays, its revenues. There's nothing like that that exists for the hidden tax of regulation. So I started pulling together figures on pages in the Federal Register, which is the daily compendium of rules and regulations, numbers of rules at the proposed stage, rules at the final stage, and just sort of tracking those kinds of data to get an idea of the scope of federal intervention in society. And so I've been doing this a long time. There are various estimates of the cost. I use a placeholder of around $2 trillion annually for cost, which is almost more than the corporate income tax and the individual income tax combined. So regulation is huge. Other folks have estimates that are considerably more than mine. The federal government ought to measure itself officially and tell us this kind of thing, but it really doesn't. So that's one of the reasons I do this report. It might interest listeners to know that just this year, only about a month ago now, the federal government, the White House, finally put out a new report to Congress on costs and benefits of regulations. Now, it only rounds up a few billion of those costs, or a lot more, I think, than what the federal government tells you. However, this is one of the problems with disclosure. This report was 3 years overdue. The last time we'd seen one was for fiscal year 2019, so we got a little bit of a catch-up volume here. So the way you can think of it is, as untethered as federal spending is, it's regulation that's the least disciplined part of the federal regulatory of the federal enterprise. And so I like to compile this report, 10,000 Commandments, to sort of grapple with it. And I think it's becoming even more important now, as in the wake of the COVID pandemic, which was the third big economic shock of the 21st century, not the first. And each time the response has been a lot of government spending and a lot of new regulation. And there's a lot of new regulation, I fear, to come from new mega laws like the CARES Act, the American Rescue Plan, the Infrastructure Law, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Inflation Act. Those are huge, gargantuan, multi-hundred billion dollar pieces of legislation. And I think we're going to start to see some of the regulatory chickens come home to roost.
Former President Donald Trump, Wayne, had made a big issue out of reducing federal regulations. And in fact, during his presidency, he made some progress in that regard. I would assume the Biden administration has slammed that into reverse.
Yes. With Trump, we had something of a reversal in kind of the headlong rush of the administrative state and all of its rules. With Trump, now he did plenty of his own of regulation of his own. You know, he had ethanol programs, he had trade policies that are still criticized heavily, and even in the free market circles, he had the artificial intelligence directive that preceded Biden's, different things like that that were regulatory for Trump. But he was most noted for the one in, two out campaign. In other words, if an agency wanted to issue a significant rule, it needed to eliminate at least two others. The gist of that was, that was the framing of it, but the gist of it was a regulatory cost freeze. The goal of that whole program was zero net new cost in regulations. And by some measures, that certainly did succeed in the first couple of years. And then, of course, it would get, as you pick the low-hanging fruit, it would get harder to offset rules. But for a time under Trump, I would say there are thousands of rules that come out every year. Usually there are at least 3,000. But under Trump, for the first time and only time, the number of rules dropped a little bit below 3,000. Still a lot of rules, but it dropped below 3,000. But as you can see, that kind of thing just being done by a president is hard to sustain. In other words, Trump could do that for 4 years, but then once Biden came in, he issued first a memoranda, then recently, this year, in fact, he issued a memoranda and an executive order 2 years apart, both entitled Modernizing Regulatory Review. And as a part of the initial Modernizing Review Directive, he eliminated the Trump executive orders with respect to streamlining regulation and with respect to doing one in, two out.
Tell us a bit about some of the responses, some of the actions that can be taken to start dialing back this regulatory state.
You got to start with the low-hanging fruit, I guess, when you're in this kind of environment where that's so contentious. This is contentious compared to anything I've seen since I've been doing public policy. However, there is bipartisan interest in notions like a so-called regulatory budget, cost budget. In fact, the idea even came from the Carter administration. So there's some little bit of interest there. Also, it's not just the laws we get from Congress and then the thousands of regulations, but there are also lots and lots of guidance documents and circulars and memoranda and notices and all these sub-regulatory decrees that also have regulatory effect. Well, there's bipartisan interest in dealing with those. A bill to address and disclose those guidance documents was reported out of a House committee 41-0. It was unanimous support among Republicans and Democrats. So addressing disclosure, like with guidance documents, a regulatory budget, regulatory reduction commissions are another bipartisan idea. I do this 10,000 commandments report kind of as a report card. The federal government should do that itself. I shouldn't need to write this report. So that would be another one I could say that would kind of be a feather in my cap, too. A little bit better disclosure, a lot more accountability.
We have been talking with Wayne Cruz, who is the Fred L. Smith Fellow in Regulatory Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Wayne, tell us a bit about the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Also, where can folks go on the web if they would like to read 10,000 Commandments?
Well, yes, thank you for asking. We are at CEI.org, and CEI is a market-oriented, small-L libertarian, you might say, think tank.
Wayne Cruz of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Wayne, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for thinking of us.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. There's been a lot of polling in the presidential race, polling showing Donald Trump taking the lead in most of the battleground states. But will the Old Dominion, Virginia, become a battleground state as well? We're going to talk about that with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me back, Loman. It's great to talk to you.
Normally, Scott, most folks will look at the Commonwealth of Virginia and will say, yeah, that's going to be a blue state. But some of the polling that has been done recently suggests this could become a battleground as well. What's the polling showing?
Listen, I think something's happening all across America. We've seen it in the polling trends in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, the traditional swing states. Trump is doing really, really well against Joe Biden. And back in May, Roanoke College conducted a poll here in Virginia, and it showed that Joe Biden had a 16-point lead. Well, they polled the race again in August, and his 16-point lead decreased all the way down to 9 points. And then they polled the race again this month, and what do we see? We see a 4-point race, and Biden is officially under 50% at 48%, and Trump is at 44%. So a 4% race really within the margin of error on everything that's going on. And I think that the big news here in Virginia is that Joe Biden is no longer winning among independents. Both of Trump and Biden are currently splitting independents at 46%. And there's a lot of identified independent voters here within the Commonwealth of Virginia. And when it comes to winning elections, building a coalition that can win, I think a lot of people are starting to take a second look at the policies that people like Donald Trump stand for, in contrast to really the incompetency of President Biden and his administration. There was a report this week as well from the Joint Economic Committee Republicans, right? So this is an official standing committee of the U.S. Congress, but it's split between Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate. So the Republicans put out a report this week, and it talked about the typical American household needing to spend $11,434 annually just to enjoy the same standard of living that they had in January of 2021. And you can actually go to their report and you can click on every state or commonwealth in the country, right? When you click on Pennsylvania, the cost of living hasn't changed there as much as the national average. It's $9,511. But in Virginia, it's $12,230 for that household. And so when you think about 4 years of President Biden and the annual cumulative costs of a household, that's almost $50,000. And you remember this cornerstone promise that Joe Biden made in the 2020 election was, I am not going to raise taxes on the middle class. And the reality is that inflation is the hidden tax, and the effect of inflation for households in Virginia is $49,000 over 4 years. And I think when people look back and they say, am I better off today than I was 4 years ago? And this is looking forward in a year, right? But they're going to be looking back and judging the 4 years of President Biden. I think it's very much similar to the Carter administration and his presidency with historic inflation and honestly losing his race in a big, big election for Ronald Reagan in 1980. And then obviously in 84, we had one of the most historic landslides in our nation's history. So I think that when you look at the polling that I described here in Virginia, 48, 44, and you just see how that is trending from what was a 16-point race in May to where we are today at the beginning of December, I think that it is showing that there is something happening nationally and Joe Biden is going to lose in the 2024 election.
The polling would seem to indicate that at this point in time. You know, in this past election, Scott, Governor Glenn Youngkin was attempting to get control of both houses of the Virginia legislature. That didn't happen, and the national media was portraying it as a big defeat. But drill down for us a bit on the numbers. It actually was pretty close.
Yeah, I think that the legacy media rushed to click publish with their editorial team and try to put out this narrative that Glenn Youngkin lost and lost big. And that's just not true. Number one, he picked up seats in the state Senate. The state Senate now is 21-19 with the Democrats holding that majority. But If you look at one of the races out here in Prince William County, Bill Wolf lost by 4%. It was less than 2,000 votes. And when you think about the state Senate majority coming down to less than 2,000 votes, and then you unpack what happened in the House of Delegates, where it's 51-49, again, very, very close. It was less than 1,000 votes in two of those delegate races that really decided the House of Delegates majority, too. So really, Youngkin was very, very close to having what's known as the trifecta of power. And when I also look at the popular vote in Virginia, it was effectively a toss-up within 3,000 votes. So we know that Virginia is a competitive state. I think that the polling from Roanoke College substantiates that message. It's going to be competitive, and states are going to be in play that a lot of people had sort of written off ever really since Barack Obama was running for president and had a very, very successful election in 2008.
The Old Dominion, Virginia, now a battleground state. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C. And everybody can check out the website, clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Okay.
What lessons does the election of a new right-wing president in Argentina have for American conservatives and the candidacy of Donald Trump? We get the answer from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
It's not often that elections in other parts of the world make big headlines here in the United States, but we did have one instance of that occurring earlier this month when Javier Milei, a self-described classical liberal and anarcho-capitalist, won Argentina's presidential election with a promise to make some big changes to the way the political structure of that country operates. And voters obviously responded pretty well to his message, and understandably so, given the runaway inflation that has wrecked Argentina's economy in recent years. But what can American politicians, and specifically American conservative politicians, learn from what happened this month in Argentina? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal, and allow me to be probably the last to wish you a belated happy Thanksgiving. We turn our gaze this week to the Southern Hemisphere, where, again, Javier Milei has been elected as the new president of Argentina. A guy who can be categorized in a lot of different ways, but broadly speaking, he would be a libertarian, like those of us at Reason. And so he's somebody that we've paid particular attention to, but I think there's lessons in this election for politicians on the whole right side of the American political spectrum. Now, whether Milei will be able to do any of the things that he's promised, like slashing government programs, cutting taxes, and privatizing state-owned enterprises, that all depends on some other factors, some of which are beyond his control. Things like how much support he can muster in the legislature and his willingness to follow through on those big campaign trail promises. Those are issues of great importance for the future of Argentina, but a lot of these questions can't be answered today. We need to wait and see what happens. One thing that we can say today, one thing that we can definitively answer today, is the political question that was raised by Milei's candidacy in this campaign for office. Can voters experiencing economic turmoil be persuaded that government is the problem rather than the solution? And the answer seems to be yes. Milei won 56% of the vote in the final round of Argentina's election. That's a figure, by the way, that President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump can only dream of approaching next November. It's almost certain that neither of them will get near 56%. And I think it's really interesting that that victory seems to have been driven in no small part by young and working class voters. In fact, reporting from on the ground in Argentina suggests that it was many of the poorest neighborhoods in Buenos Aires that were a beachhead for Milei's message of anarcho-capitalism and of getting rid of state institutions that have obviously failed to lift Argentinians out of poverty, and that he blamed for the runaway inflation that has sacked the country's economy. Now, Milei is a political novice, and he's a former TV commentator, and he's loudly trashed political norms and Argentina's ruling establishment, so it's been easy for American media to compare him to former President Trump and to the wave of right-wing populists that the former president has inspired within the Republican Party. But once you get past the aesthetics, I think the similarities between Milei and the MAGA movement, they mostly vanish. Take a look at how the New York Times summarizes Malai's platform. The paper says that he wants to lower taxes / regulations, privatize state industries, and reduce the number of federal ministries from 18 to 8. He wants to shift public education to a voucher-based system and public health care to an insurance-based system. He also wants to cut federal spending by up to 15% of Argentina's gross domestic product. And additionally, he's said that as long as the state doesn't have to pay for it, he could support drug legalization, open immigration, sex work, transgender rights, same-sex marriage, and even the selling of organs. While there might be some overlap with American conservatives in some of those categories, like cutting taxes and slashing regulations, the rest of Malai's political agenda is expressly libertarian, and it's often directly at odds with the aims of the new right or the economic nationalists that have risen within the Republican Party in the wake of Trump's presidency. The loudest contingent of the American conservative movement these days often seems to be promising a more muscular and centralized government as the answer to social problems. Malai's victory is not a part of that narrative. He's not coming at these problems from that direction. In fact, he's doing quite the opposite. Now, that doesn't mean that his victory isn't a populist one. In fact, it certainly is that, but it seems to have more in common with the so-called Tea Party era of Republican politics, when American conservatives were calling for slashing government programs and spending. Or, if you'd like, it's got some similarities to the surprising but ultimately unsuccessful presidential runs by former Congressman Ron Paul back during the 2000s. More accurately, though, since we really shouldn't view any other country's politics through an American lens, Malai's victory seems like a callback to the ideas that once helped Argentina become one of the world's richest countries. Daniel Reisbach writes for Reason that the country of Argentina benefited for decades from the ideas of Juan Bautista Alberti, a classical liberal polymath whose writings informed the country's 1853 constitution. Following Alberti's lead, Argentina embraced free markets and free trade, and prosperity followed. Buenos Aires began to rival New York commercially and Paris aesthetically. But then Argentina's leaders embraced economic nationalism in the 1920s, and the country has been on a century-long economic decline ever since. So Malai's election kind of looks like a rejection of that kind of economic nationalism, of central planning of all forms. There are, of course, serious limits to how useful any foreign election can be as a guide for U.S. politicians. The political terrain in Argentina is very different from what we have here in the United States, and obviously the runaway inflation rate there makes everything that we've experienced in the past few years look pretty tame. And even libertarians like myself should be cautious about fully embracing Malai until we get some answers to those bigger questions about how he will actually govern and what will he be able to accomplish. And as always, we should judge him based on policy, not politics. But as a political matter, Malai's win should be a beacon to pro-freedom politicians in the Northern Hemisphere, too. Not only is it possible to run a campaign based on cutting the size and scope of government, but his victory suggests that there might be an unexpectedly large coalition of voters out there prepared to reward that kind of boldness. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of that election in Argentina and everything else going on around this country at Reason.com. This week is also our annual webathon, so click over to Reason.com/donate. And if you can, chip in a few bucks to help us keep reporting on all the top news that affects free minds and free markets.
Low taxes and pro-growth economic policies are driving Florida's population growth. So says Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. The famous opening of Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities is just as applicable to life today as it was when Dickens first published that story. No example of that is clearer than the tale of two states, actually. The contrast between left-wing California and free market governed Florida, as was debated on primetime television this week with the showdown between Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and Gavin Newsom of California. The free state of Florida, a success story in state public policy, is a model for other states to imitate. California, on the other hand, is a model for other states to avoid. California most reminds us of the famous line from the great Ronald Reagan. The liberal view of the economy can be summed up as this: if it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. just look at where people are voting with their feet today. Data from the Internal Revenue Service, as well as United Van Lines and U-Haul, show that Americans are increasingly moving from high-tax states like California to low-tax states like Florida. Families and businesses cannot get out of California fast enough today. On the other hand, Americans are flocking to the Sunshine State. In the last decade, Florida has gained more than 1.6 million residents from net domestic migration from the other 49 states, while California lost more than 1.5 million over the same time period. Naysayers would argue that taxes don't matter when it comes to where people choose to move, but from domestic migration alone, it's clear that that's a myth. The nine states without a personal income tax gained a total of 3.6 million residents over the last decade, while the nine states with the highest personal income taxes lost 3.3 million residents over that same time period. The same naysayers will argue that it's the weather, of all things, causing Americans to move. We're often told that Americans are moving south and west for better climate in terms of the weather into states that just happen to have lower taxes and pro-growth policies. The case of California clearly refutes that migration can be explained by weather alone. Of course, the Golden State, with its highly desirable Mediterranean climate, is losing residents at a faster pace than any other state besides high-tax New York. When asked to decide between two warm climates, Florida and California, the data show people move to Florida, the place with a better economic policy. In the latest edition of the Alec Laffer Economic Outlook Rankings from Rich States, Poor States, Florida came in ninth best for economic outlook and first for economic performance. Meanwhile, California has ranked 45th for economic outlook. Florida beats California in 13 out of the 15 variables considered in Rich States, Poor States. As Kansas Policy Institute President Dave Traubert and I noted in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago, the 41 states with an income tax spent 55% more per resident per year than the states without an income tax. That's the secret to the success of the no-income tax states. They're more frugal with spending taxpayer dollars. Florida, which doesn't have an income tax, spent roughly half as much per resident as California, which has a top marginal personal income tax rate over 13%. If all else remains equal going forward, Californians will be paying even higher taxes to pay off unfunded pension liabilities and debt, and seeing no increase in the quality of public services. While Florida has debts of its own, they're considerably smaller than those accrued by decades of careless spending in places like Sacramento. The Sunshine State is much better positioned to pay off its obligations without any tax increases. The time has long passed for lawmakers in California to see the error of their ways and make serious changes to the tax and fiscal policy system. The state's high taxes and regulations have led millions of Americans to vote with their feet, moving to states like Florida, which keep taxes low and exercise responsible spending. This enhanced focus on this tale of two states is an incredible educational opportunity for Americans as we decide what sort of government policies work best for us. It is clear Florida beats California by a country mile in every economic objective measure, and it gives states across the nation a template for greater prosperity for all of their residents. For more information, you can visit alec.org and richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KWFM-FM in Wichita Falls, Texas, WSBP-LP in Woodridge, New Jersey, along with WBNL-AM in Boonville, Indiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our all-new website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.